Welcome back to Radio or Not. I'm Nicole Sandler. Well, the response to the Ray Davies interview was pretty overwhelming, so I decided to dig back into that box of tapes and pull out a Ray Davies interview I did that really nobody has ever heard in its entirety. Shortly after the KSCA interview, I got a call from a company who was producing a syndicated radio show that I worked on occasionally, and they asked me if I would continue the interview I did with Ray for them to use in the show. And of course, I said of course. So they worked on setting up an interview that wound up happening at the airport just before Ray was to leave to go back to England. So it was after his series of shows and after he had been in LA for about a week. I did go to see 20th Century Man one evening, and it was awesome, as I knew it would be. I finished the book, X-Ray, which I highly recommend any Ray Davies fan or even casual Kinks fan read, because it's not only a great story, but written beautifully as well. This interview was never meant to be broadcast in its entirety. Just excerpts of Ray's answers were going to be taken and used in this syndicated program. So I was not mic'd, so I've done my best to boost the level so you could hear the questions. Really, the only editing I did was to take out some coughs and sniffles. After a week or so in Los Angeles, Ray came down with a pretty nasty cold. He wasn't feeling that great, but being the guy he is, sat down for this interview in the Admiral's Club at LAX. We talked right up until the time they called for his flight. So here you have it, Ray Davies, part two on Radio or Not.
I'll just kind of continue where
we left off.
Yeah, even though this is for a different thing, I'll give you
okay.
That tip.
So yeah.
Don't have to backtrack.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things that I didn't get to ask you about.
Hmm.
What is? reading the book.
Yeah.
X-Ray, we were talking about. I got the feeling that there was another reason other than just to write a book. It seemed very therapeutic, very cathartic. Did you have something in mind when you set out to do this?
I didn't intend it to be therapeutic. I suppose when, you know, the first thing they did, they came to me and they said, would you write an autobiography? And I said, no. Because I've read other things. I didn't want somebody to ghost it for me. And so many of these books are ghosted. So I said, I'll write it because I'll get the critics anyway. And people will sort of slam me for it. So I may as well write it. But I'm not interested in writing a regular autobiography because I don't think it would convey what our band's about. And my what I call the underbelly of the story, can't think of another way of saying it, the backstory is this kid, which is basically, the kid is basically meeting me when I'm 75 years old, and I'm the 19-year-old kid. And also that's, I feel that that's kind of a pivotal time for me when I was 19 years old, because that's when You Really Got Me, and it was a time when everything changed. So it's me confronting myself when I'm much older. And I found that a much more expressive way of writing the story of the Kinks. And I think it's important for people to know a bit about me when I was a child, and a bit about my family. It's vital to know about the origins of my music, because I write for the Kinks. And how this extraordinary bunch of people got together. Every band's extraordinary in its own sense, but I only know about the Kinks, so I wanted to make it as in-depth as possible.
Well, obviously you focused in on the early part of the Kinks.
Yeah.
And it ended in the midst of your story, kind of at a turning point when you basically sort of got the legal problems cleared up, and your marriage and the custody battle came to an end.
Yeah.
Then you kind of got out of it by leaving the rest of your diaries and things. Will there be a part two?
No, I didn't intend it. I just wanted it to be one book. Because the reason I began it where I did, it's for obvious reasons. I Think You Really Got Me was our breakthrough single. I suppose historians of pop music, rock music, will say that that's our, you know, the seminal Kinks track or whatever. And so again, I adopted a sort of journalistic stance, and I went to the things I thought that my editor would be interested in if I were writing for a music magazine. Obviously, you go for the 60s, which I hate to talk about when people interview me, simply because, you know, I've done other stuff in other decades. But the reason I ended it 73 was because I think that it is a time when my creative, not flow, came to an end, but when that cycle came to an end. I'd finished writing the sort of songs, like in a sense, Innocence, I'd written, starting up as a writer with the band, and it had gone on that whole curve of trying to grow up, establishing adulthood and all that. And it was an interesting time to finish it, because after that I did go on and write other things. We did soap opera preservation and all those. So again, it's kind of all full of metaphor and other meanings, but I think when RD dies, a certain part of me was over.
Yeah, definitely,
yeah.
Do you see the future in that belief?
No, even in like the downside in my book, when I start talking about when I was an art student, I saw skeletons walking around the road or driving cars. It's just my outlook on the world. I suppose I've got this kind of, what's the word? A dark outlook, but it's not completely without hope. In fact, I'm very optimistic about things. In fact, a lot of my friends think that I'm a little bit too optimistic at times, almost to the point of being flippant about it. You know, you can be the most optimistic person in the world, walk over the road and get killed by a truck. It's just, you know, it's a dark book, but then my background's dark. Victorian Britain was dark. The height of the British Empire is probably the most evil time ever, most corrupt time. Because that's what probably kills all these great empires. You know, Britain's no exception.
What's life like over there now?
It's sort of, we're making a good job of it in England. We've got some good bands emerging. You know, music has done really, in America, you really give the musicians just rewards, I think. They get treated a bit better. In Britain, it's still considered to be that nasty little lifestyle that people get into, and it's not a real job. But to actually think about it in those terms is wrong. It defeats the whole object of making music. You know, to think that it's something outside the society. You know, they like it there for entertainment, but it's not really a serious job.
Could it possibly be that when bands are young, I mean, there are kids doing it like you were when you started, and maybe once you pass that initial phase, then you move into, you're a respected musician.
But why? I mean, why, you know, and I'm not, the only reason I make this sort of comparison, but you get artists like Picasso and Rembrandt, artists, painters, and they write and draw pictures, whatever.
And aren't they more respected though after they die?
After they die, but you know, Picasso moved on and wrote his other, painted his other pictures, and you get people like George Bernard Shaw. I kept writing, and not even big successful authors, but an author is. And a painter, it's definitely something that is more establishment than... I know what you're saying. I think there's a different perception of what rock music is in England, and they still don't take it, not that it should be taken seriously, but they don't treat it with... It's made Britain, it's kept Britain afloat for the last 30 years, the Beatles. You know, when the Beatles were at their height and storming America, Britain was in terrible economic crisis. It didn't have any exports, it had nothing. And popular music really was our biggest export for a while. But, you know, we weren't given any sort of breaks for doing it. I'm not saying that we should. It's just a little bit of a acknowledgement from time to time.
Well, out of that whole British invasion era, I mean, there's the Beatles and the Stones,
yeah.
And the Kinks.
Yeah.
And the others, you know, they have hits or what, but they're not, so they haven't persevered. They haven't lived on.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody yesterday because there's, you know, possibility my show might be a film now, and we were discussing what it was that made those particular bands come out at that particular time and make something so enduring and so sort of make its mark. I think it had a lot to do with the generation, you know, the first generation in Britain after the Second World War that didn't have to cover up its origins, that wrote about what it experienced, and primarily from a working class aspect, because all musicians, you know, when singers and I remember a guitarist called Julian Bream, who's a classical English guitarist, yes, a classical player, and there, I don't know this for a fact, but Julian Bream, when he became a concert guitarist, had to take elocution lessons so he could talk posh, and that is, I'm not saying that's absolutely true, but that's I would believe that to be the case.
Some people would think he was from a more class of that.
Yeah, and acting. You know, you look at British movies. You go back to see British movies in the 1930s and 40s, before the Second World War, and you get a sort of a docker come on, you know, a working class man coming in. Hey, where shall I put this? He's obviously an actor that sort of doesn't want to put on a working class. He doesn't say, hey, governor, what do I do? It was something that kind of, it's what was called the leisure classes, controlled arts and media and music in Britain. All the newscasters spoke like the Queen or the King.
Here it's more a regional thing. There is more of
Yeah, is it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you did a wonderful New York accent the other night. Yeah. The show.
But there is, you know, someone comes from Brooklyn and tries to talk, they're not taken as seriously as someone who comes from Connecticut.
That's right.
Yeah. And this, all this Harvard, and Yale snobbery. You know, what's great about it over here, it is to be, people said there was no class system in America, but I remember when I finally moved here and lived here for a bit, on a more sort of regular basis, you see it. And you confront it all the time, you know, in places like New York, because it is kind of it's a waspy world. That tries.
You don't hear it as much, you don't hear it in terms of accents. You hear it in terms of vocabulary and the way people speak like that, but not in terms of accents.
No. Like, but I think it's a thing that can be acquired over here easily. I think it's more to do with money in America. But anyway, going back to the thing that started, I think it was a class thing, and working class people like the Beat, John Lennon particularly, not sure about the others, but he was a working class person. And the art school movement in Britain was very important. I think that, so those generation, that generation, I don't know where Pete Townsend was, what he did before, but I know Keith Richard was taught at art school. So all these people came from a similar background, and I think that's part of the movement. And you follow on from people in the 50s, like John Osborne, who were the angry young playwrights in Britain, and wrote plays like Look Back in Anger, that changed the whole focus of what British drama was about, writing about what they call kitchen sink drama, which is drama about the ordinary people. And so following on five or six years later, you had an affair in Britain called the Profumo Affair, where one of the heads of the government was found in bed with a call girl who also slept with a Russian general or something. And he resigned. And so that was the first time British politics were actually seen in the media to have been caught with their trousers down, he had to resign. So all these things colliding together, and Christine Keeler, I don't know if you remember the movie, but Christine Keeler, Mandy Rice Davis, were two, at the time, I think, call girls, who became great socialites, you know? And that turned the aristocracy in Britain almost upside down overnight. So all these things colliding together, and then the Beatles coming through, I think all helped to let this music and this pop art culture, whatever, emerge.
The world was changing,
and it was changing here. It was changing here as well. You had a young president here who was like, everybody thought was wonderful. Not everybody, obviously, but people thought it was an on and up. And it was the young people taking the world over. And it wasn't something you had to wait until you were 40 for before you could inherit.
You speak of theater and art and painting and all that, and you have all of that in you. You're very, very artistically minded. You started out in art school, and you create theater, you create drama. You do that in your music, but you also do it in your shows.
Yeah.
Do you paint? Do you?
No, I don't paint as much as I'd like to. The problem I have is it's just, the reason I stopped painting, I know I talk about it in the show, but they're a bit more, I was a bit more intense than that. I really wanted to do painting. You just have to give your whole life to it, and it is quite lonely. At least with songs, you can get out there and sing it to people, even if you just play a coffee bar or sing it to your friends. You don't get the same feedback when you're doing pictures.
It's more social.
Yeah.
The show is 20th Century Man. How long have you been doing
that? We were talking the other day. I think we've done about 200 shows now. It's a lot of shows.
And now you're talking about putting it on film.
Well, there's an idea that people want me to put it on film, but it would have to be to translate from stage to film. It would be a really different thing. You have to rewrite it and stuff. But I don't want it to lose its innocence, because I still want the show, and I still try to keep the show... I could try to keep the show as if it were me just going on stage and making it up, which is what we actually did when I first did it. I just didn't know what I was going to do. I had a few pieces of book I wanted to read and a few songs. I just made it up. And every night, until recently, I was just sort of changing things as it went along.
You do have that theatrical sense. Recently, well, obviously Pete Townsend translated Tommy into a Broadway show, and now they're gonna do a stage production of Quadrophenia in London next month. Mm. Would you like to do that again? Would you like to take one of your old masterpieces? And
well, I don't know about that. I'd like to write a new one. I think it's something to be said for resurrecting old stuff. I think with Tommy, I think what they did, and I can't really comment on it because I haven't seen it, but they turned a concept album into a stage musical and did work on the narrative, which is nice, and made it more accessible to people, but turned it into another beast, really. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what they're doing with Quadrophenia. You know, the parallels end there, I think, between the two bands, because I think they are very well, certainly when they wrote Tommy, they their music was more in the head, and my stuff was always about people I knew. My character studies.
So you base your characters on real people.
Yeah, I'm just writing about people, not about history. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to rewrite the cosmos. Right. I admire people that do try. But I'm very interested in the world and people. And you know, I had the song where I said, everybody's a star, everybody's a dreamer, and they are. You know, I saw a kid today as I left the hotel, and he was just had a few songs. And I said, well, what's your problem with your writing? And I said, well, he said, I have X problem. And I said, well, write about that. And I said, I'm checking out in 2 hours, write the song. And I came back as I checked out and he'd written it. But he was on the way to doing it. You know, I think it's important that everybody has a chance to communicate. You know, and in the show at the end, I started saying something about through music. You know, you're not just an audience. I think we know one another through all the music. And it is what it's become. It's become a great source of communication, popular music, rock music. And there's an attitude, a sort of a shortcut language, a sort of a shorthand that people can talk now, that is rock and roll talk. You know, that we can say something and relate to it. And before rock music came along, I don't think we could have done that, you and I, mm-hmm. because we're two different countries. Right. We come from two different cultures. But rock music is definitely at the end of this, certainly since the end of the 50s, has become the art form. Now video, obviously, internet, all that is taking over. I push that into the next century.
Mm. People can connect with music. I mean, it's often just a unifying factor. If two people meet and find that they have the same love of music and love of the same sort of music, that's right there enough to take them to another level. I know we don't have a lot of time because you've got your plane, but the Kinks, you've got the Ray Davies going with the book and the solo show and all your own personal work, but you still keep the Kinks going.
Well, it's not a question of keeping it going. I think it's something that exists outside me. It's like not Frankenstein's monster, but it's like this. It's like the alien. It's lost. You think it's not there, you know, but it's somewhere in the pipes or something, and then it will come out and say, "Wow, it's there." The Kinks is a bit like that. It exists.
And it's part of you.
Yeah, it's part of me, and I like to think that there's more to do. But you know, when I talk to the guys, we've just got this new record that's coming out, To the Bone, and there are some new tracks on it. We've done To the Bone, which I do in the 20th Century Man show. I've done it. It was really hard recording it for the Kinks because I didn't want to push any of my stage style onto it that I had done in my solo show. It's a different record. So I let the guys, and Dave in particular, put his own guitar inflections in. And maybe my stage version is for a solo record. And a song called Animal that I did last time round. I didn't do it this time in 20th Century Man, but that's more a pop song about a girl I used to know who was like part of our entourage. She used to follow us. Not a groupie, but she was just an advisor. All the smart bands that start out have a group of people around them that actually follow them around and give them pointers, you know. Fever, and it's about her, and in her case, the song is called Animal, but yeah, the song, there it is. So we've done this to the Bone album, and after this, I'd like to think that there are new things to do. I can't just exist on the work I've done. You know, if I just do that, I may as well just get a gardening job.
Right.
You know,
creating.
You've got to do that, even if you're not, if it's not great stuff. I mean, you can't say to yourself, it's all right, and I can go and go to like so many people. I don't know how they do it. Go to a club and say, just do the old hits for half an hour. That's not my way.
Yeah, and you can't say it's not great stuff till you do it, because you don't
know
until.
Nope.
Will you tour with To the Bone?
Maybe. We'll see how we all behave. We're doing a couple of test dates in the summer in Europe and see how we get on. It is like that. And whether there's anything worth recording in the future, it's really down to that. All right. Yeah, it's got to go. Thanks for all your support. I'm sorry you had to come out this way. Yeah.
So now I'm sure you could see why Ray Davies is one of my favorite interviews of all time. He's just totally charming and disarming at the same time. You heard him tell the story about the young man at the hotel who was having trouble writing a song. Well, Ray was late showing up for our interview. We were supposed to have a bit more time together, but he wound up sitting with that young man and helping him with this song. That just shows a little bit more about him. Ray came back into town, into Los Angeles, a few months later. I had actually sent him a birthday card to his studio in the UK. And when he was in town, he called. And we went out to dinner, shared a bottle of wine, and talked and talked and talked music and books. And a friend of mine had a record out, and he was playing a little show at a little dive bar on Fairfax called Molly Maguire's. And I took Ray to see John Ondrasik and his band Five for Fighting. Now, this was back in 1996, long before Superman became a huge hit. I just had the best time. He was a perfect gentleman, much to my dismay, I suppose. and I haven't seen or spoken to Ray since. Hopefully that'll change. I actually just sent him a note a few days ago letting him know that I was going to put these interviews up on this podcast. So hopefully he'll hear it and get back in touch. All right. Well, that does it for this edition of Radio or Not. Got lots more of these tapes sitting in that box. So be sure to let your friends know we're here. Steer them towards radioornot.com and check back periodically, okay? I'm Nicole Sandler. Thanks for listening.